On Sunday, January 6th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents Floridian Reeds Man, composer, and twin Marcus Strickland. Marcus Strickland's Twilight Band has a release titled People of the Sun and will be on stage during one of the upcoming New York Winter Jazz Festival marathon nights. That's Sunday, January 6th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program, and my name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is Reeds Man Marcus Strickland. Marcus Strickland plays tenor, alto, soprano, saxophones, bass, clarinet, not to mention drum programming, and he's probably learning something else, even as we speak. Marcus Strickland's going to be featured at this year's New York Winter Jazz Festival, and we'll find out more about that during our On the Bandstand segment. This is also the last evening that Sugar in My Bowl will be airing on Sundays. Sugar in My Bowl will now be a weekly program, airing on Tuesday evenings from 10 p.m. to midnight. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I want some sugar. Thank you.
my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Marcus Strickland.
Marcus Strickland, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I appreciate the time you're going to spend with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
You were born in Gainesville, Florida, and you grew up in Miami.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get a story from your family of why you moved to Miami?
Well, my family's from Miami. My dad was born in Miami. My mom was born in Detroit. We moved to Miami when she was very young. And they had us in Gainesville when my dad was going to law school.
Your father's a lawyer?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Hey, I'm not one of those people who knows everything about you.
Oh, it's cool. It's all good.
Are there other siblings in the household? Of course, I know about EJ, your drummer twin.
No, we were all they wanted.
Okay.
They didn't ask for two. They sure got it.
So what was it like growing up, just the two of you? I know you eventually wound up playing together.
No, it was great. We had a cool nuclear family, which is quite rare these days, but we weren't raised to take it for granted. Yeah, we appreciated what we had, so we had a great life growing up, I think.
How did you both wind up being directed or direct yourselves into the area of music?
Well, that probably had to do with my dad. He would play the stereo into my mother's womb.
Wow.
He would play all kinds of incredible music in there. I mean, they say that it helps babies. I'm not sure how much that's true, but it started from there. And when we were growing up, we would grow up in front of a stereo, basically. We had two little rocking chairs. When we were very small, and we would rock our chairs to the music and everything, and there was always incredible music being played, and he was very eclectic in his taste. He loved jazz, of course, but he loved many other types of music too. So we definitely had a great upbringing that was not really genre-based. It was, like, good. So I like it. I think that's part of the reason why we gravitated towards jazz by the time we were 11. Because in my opinion, I think jazz kind of encompasses everything. It's kind of like the scientists of music in some respect. But at the same time, it's some of the most soulful, heartfelt music on the planet, too. So, yeah, it encompasses just about everything from my heart's desire. By the time we were 11, we were trying to pick an extracurricular class. And then we were realizing we were a little too shy for acting, too shy for vocal music. But we liked instrumental music. For some reason, both of us liked that when we saw the choice. And we took the class, and the introduction of the instruments was very exciting. We had seen these instruments before, but to see them up close and personal was incredible. Steve Kirkland was the name of my middle school teacher at Hammocks Middle School. Yeah, he showed us tuba and all that stuff. He saved the saxophone for last, and I think he saved the saxophone for last because he is a saxophonist. He might have had a little favoritism there, but at the same time, the saxophone is kind of a combination of everything he showed before that. You know, he showed brass instruments, he showed woodwind instruments, he showed stuff that had keys on it, and then he showed the saxophone, and it had all of that. And plus, it just looks cool. It's just shaped all funny, and it's like everything else has like a straight pipe, and then there's a bell. Mm. And this one is a cone, you know, it's a conical bore. Scientifically, I wasn't looking at it like that. It was beautiful. So yeah, I fell in love with the instrument, and I said, I want to play that immediately. And Steve Kirkland, he wanted me to play the clarinet and then go to the saxophone, which is pedagogically the way to do it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, clarinet is far harder than saxophone, and also it's kind of like a staple in the woodwind family. It kind of teaches you how to play all the woodwinds because the recorder was the very first woodwind. But I was like, no, I want to play saxophone. And I played that, and when we chose our instruments, we went home, and our dad was like, so what happened? Like, yeah, I'm going to play the saxophone. My brother's like, oh, I'm going to play the drums. And he got excited, too. Very supportive. And then immediately he pulls out my favorite things, John Coltrane's version.
Uh-huh.
And he starts playing it. He's like, do you recognize this song? I'm like, yeah. What's that, Sound of Music? That's my favorite thing. Like, yeah. And that's the great thing about what John Coltrane did here. He took like a pop tune from a very important film, very popular film.
Right.
Took that music and approached it differently every single time he approached the melody. You know, that's what's called improvisation. So he kind of was breaking down what was going on in the recording, and we just became very fascinated. So our introduction into music from a hands-on point of view was through this genre that a lot of people like to call jazz. But, like, we like everything.
Right.
We were listening to MC Hammer when he was popular.
Sure.
We were listening to N.W.A. when they were popular.
Right.
And N.W.A. would make fun of him. So, like, we liked everything. But with instrumental music and having the taste that we had musically, I understand why we like that. We grew up learning our instruments through that, and we were listening to everything. And by the time I got to college, I was playing tenor saxophone instead of alto saxophone.
Was alto your first?
Mm-hmm. That was the one I started on. The next saxophone that I got from my parents was a soprano saxophone. I got obsessed about that because I heard John Coltrane
right.
playing a soprano saxophone.
Right.
But I generally like the B-flat instruments better because by the time I was in high school, I was listening to Joe Henderson. I was listening to Wayne Shorter, Brent Marsalis, Joe Lovano. It was like all these guys I was listening to played tenor. So naturally, I switched to tenor. I played tenor and soprano. And yeah, it was cool. went to an arts high school, so we were surrounded by a lot of people who were doing the same thing as us. Great musical upbringing, great everything. You know, I'm very grateful for it. We concluded that we needed to get to New York.
Yeah, so what led you to New York?
Well, basically, when you go through the history, the music started in Congo Square, and then it progressed to Chicago. That's where the swing pattern really got developed. Mm-hmm. Then it got to New York, and it kind of stayed there for a while. And the New York lifestyle called for that type of music. So we were like, okay, are we going to stay here in Miami and end up in Gloria Estefan's band, or are we going to go to New York and play the music we want to play? Because there's not really that many jazz clubs in Miami. Most of the scene was University of Miami. You know, it was within the Petri dish in the classroom. Uh-huh. So, yeah, we went to New York because we wanted to experience it in its natural habitat.
Right.
And experience it outside of the classroom. So went there. It was good to have a person who liked music as much as me to
Being
grow
EJ.
Up with. Yeah, it was a very cool thing to go through together. We wound up living in Brooklyn, and I think shortly after I got to college, I started really dissecting the hip-hop I was listening to. Because, you know, I was listening to a whole lot of Tribe. I was listening to a whole lot of Slum Village. And I was just wondering, like, why certain hip-hop artists, their music sounded better. Mm. And I was like, That's when I really started becoming more aware of producers and how producers provide that sound. There would be certain tracks of Tribe that I would like more than others, or Slum Village that I would like more than others. And then what I found out was that Jay Dilla is the answer. So I really got obsessed with Jay Dilla in early college. I won the saxophone competition in 2002. By that time, I was playing with Jeff Tame Watts and also Roy Haynes.
Yes, exactly. You are one of the members of the Fountain of Youth.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be right back. a very exciting time. I was playing with my heroes, and I was also playing with the lineage of the music. Roy changed the drums and music. He changed the sound, the utilization of the hi-hat. One of the very first things that I noticed when I saw him play live for the first time, his boots. Kurt, first of all, because they were fly, and also because his left boot was just chilling on the hi-hat stand. It wasn't going up and down on the hi-hat stand. It was just chilling on the hi-hat stand. Every now and then, he would press it for a little accent or something.
Uh-huh.
I realized that's why his beat sounds so different. It's totally reliant on the cymbal, and he freed up the hi-hat, and it frees up the beat a little bit more. It's not like two and four every time. So he would change it up. And that's basically the thing that he contributed to the sound of the drums and the music. To play with somebody like that, that's that innovative, that creative, that stylish, that's funny, you know.
Right.
That was a great experience. My first official gig with Jeff Tane Watts was at Jazz Showcase, and it happened to be the week after I played at the Jazz Showcase with Roy Haynes.
Oh, wow.
So I played 2 weeks consecutively at the Jazz Showcase, first with Roy Haynes, and then with Jeff Ken Watts. That was incredible. This is all during a time that I was getting into beats. So, like, I'll be so inspired by the music. And then when I get home, I'm trying to make these beats. And I love Dilla and Madlib. At the time, I was heavy into Madlib and the Mad Villainy stuff that he did along with MF Doom. And I was just making all this stuff on the side and then playing my saxophone by night. Around 2005, it kind of started melding together, and I put out this record called Twilight.
Right.
And that's when I had my acoustic quartet and my electric quartet. And at some point, Twilight just became everything that it was. Everything that I was in Twilight. Yeah, the Twilight group I have now is very much represents what I've developed into, which is a music lover. I just love music.
Now, before we focus on the latest Marcus Strickland's Twilight release, People of the mm-hmm. Sun, I do mm-hmm. want to take it back a few years before mm-hmm. 2008. And I guess I should ask, mm-hmm. now that you brought it up, what does Twilight mm-hmm. mean for you in your naming it that?
Oh, it's a funny story with this name, because I started noticing a lot of Ghanaian people would think that it's a shout out to their people.
Right, the Twi.
Like,
right.
Twi Light.
Right.
And then I was like, sorry to disappoint you, but it's just a play on words between Twilight and life.
Uh-huh.
And around that time, it was all kind of I stuff coming out from
you
Mac.
Mean,
you
yes.
know, iLife, iTunes, yes. iPod, iThis.
Right.
So I kind of came up with this quirky name, Twilight. Because I felt like I was living two lives, because I was trying to keep this stuff separate at first. This is this, and this is that. Because that's what genres do to you. You know, it makes you feel like everything is separate when actually it isn't. It's just a marketing tool. Yeah, because I was loving everything. I was loving playing with all these incredible jazz musicians, and also loving hip-hop so much and being so affected by what was going on, especially when Voodoo came down. It's like, when that dropped, it just changed everybody's world.
You're talking about D'Angelo's Voodoo.
Yes. When D'Angelo came out with Voodoo, it was like an atomic bomb went off. My jazz heroes were playing on that record. Hip-hop heroes were playing on that record. Mm-hmm. Soul music heroes were playing on that record. It was everything that we are. Everything that Black American music is was on that record. So it taught me that it's not separate. Stop living separately.
I see.
Put it all together. Why do we have to keep in these lanes? I was really inspired by that. I was inspired by all the guys who are on there separately, too. Questlove and The Roots and Roy Hargrove, of course, with his quintet, was the hottest thing at that time. And then you had Pino Palladino on bass. Incredibly warm sound, and it made me like electric bass much more than before. The way that he plays it has a very, very mellow sound, and it actually reminded me a lot of the bass sound that Jay Dilla would get sometimes. Like, he had a technique of rubbing the record, and when you rub the record, it makes this low sound, and you record that, tune it to different pitches, and apply it to a keyboard, and then you have your key bass sound. There's this program called Reason. It adopted that sound and called it Blip Bass. And there's another, I think, specific plugin on Reason that calls it another thing. It calls it Pitch Bass. It's basically that. Like, that's basically the sound of it. Yeah, that sound I felt was being replicated by Pino Palladino. And it just got me much more in tune with what was possible and the many different aspects of making music that I hadn't really been experiencing at that time. So the whole production side of me was being awakened at this time. And I like it all. That's how I became who I am.
Which is kind of clear that you like it all. You know,
yeah,
you mentioned how your father played everything when you were in the womb. And I've read other exchanges that you've had, and you make it clear that you like it all. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I've got this question, because a lot of other people that I've spoken to with regard to the concept of what is called jazz is essentially blues based, and if there is no blues aesthetic, then you just may not be playing jazz. So is that something that you understand as well?
I think I do. I mean, a lot of times when I'm playing over the stuff that I'm playing now, my blues sensibility is what gets me through. It's not the language of bebop. It's the blues language that gets me through on those beats and singing the melody phrasing. You know, there's all these other things other than the technicality of bebop that needs to be strengthened in order to play the type of music that I'm playing now. So it's like, yeah, it's all in there. There's a lot of rules, especially with jazz, man. Oh, my God. It's like, it has to have blues. It has to have swing. It has to have this. It has to have that. It's like, okay, you know, that's great. But if you have that in you, you don't have to be so adamant about it. It's in you. It's like, I live it. That stuff is in me. There's a tune that I wrote not too long ago for Chris McBride's band, and it's called Seek the Source. It's a minor blues. There's this very angular type of melody that we're playing, but it always resolves with a very bluesy lick at the end. You know, that's naturally how that tune came about. I knew that it was like a combination of many different things, but the underlying thing is the blues in that song. So that's why I called it Seek the Source.
And I guess the reason why I asked the question was, as a matter of fact, this is probably one of the few things I agree with Wynton Marsalis about, when he said that the concept of jazz is the only musical form that people run away from, saying that they're actually associated with that concept of jazz. Now,
well, I mean, I'm not going to make this into a debate.
No. And I certainly don't want to debate. I just want to discuss the concept.
It's not something I'm running from.
Okay.
It's very much a part of me.
Uh-huh.
It's in there. I don't like the word itself. It's similar to saying, I play semen.
Right.
I play semen and I squirted all over the place. It was a dismissive term when it came up. The very first recorded historic event that included that word was a baseball announcer saying, he put some jazz on that pitch.
Uh-huh.
It's not really the most noble word in the world. And also, it's a word that allows so many people to just use it and apply their culture to it while ignoring ours.
And that's exactly why I wanted to discuss this. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and there's a reason that people change words.
Uh-huh.
Words have power.
Right.
They have an energy.
Right.
There's a reason that African Bumbado said, look, we're not calling this rap. We're going to call this hip-hop. Rap is a verb. So it's like the people that he was surrounded with were probably much more liberated than the people who were the founding fathers of jazz, because it was a much more oppressive time. It's still an oppressive time now.
Right.
Back then, much less say. You could get put in jail, you could get beat up, you could get even lynched for things you say back then.
Right.
So it all goes along with what's going on historically. And I'm not trying to call out any specific person that I look up personally and debate them at all. I'm just going by what I feel in my gut.
Right.
You know, stuff that really stays, it's going to stay there.
Thank you for this. I appreciate your sharing and honesty with regard to that. You, of course, are not the first person to express this sentiment. I just wanted it to be clarified where you were coming from.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, It's kind of like a lot of times it's expressed that way when somebody actually wants to do something different than they did before, that they're running away from the past or they're running away from the truth. It's always expressed that way for some reason, but I don't know. I think I'm very glad that I don't think the same way that I thought when I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I mean,
of course.
Isn't that what life was about?
Right. We are to evolve, are we not?
Yeah, exactly.
You
know.
Got it.
You know, it's kind of counterintuitive to try to stay the same. I think people are the way they are for a reason. Great Tate exists for a great reason.
Whom you have on your latest release.
Exactly. I like the fact that I can exist in all those situations.
Right.
I'm just as comfortable in all those situations. You can put me on the bandstand with pretty much any band that's playing some Black American-based music, I can play with them.
Right.
You know, but if you put me on the bandstand with some Brazilian guys, I'm going to have some problems because I need to learn their culture.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the thing. It's like their culture is attached to a landmass.
Mm-hmm.
Our culture is not necessarily tied to a landmass. It's basically about something that we went through, the diaspora.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because Brazilians went through a similar concept.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I mean, they too were shackled and brought over.
Yeah, it's very true. But the main thing that really, I think, separates the experience in America from any other place that we were sent is that the drum was taken away.
Right.
And we were mixed up so much that we weren't surrounded by anybody who spoke the same language as us.
Right.
So I think as a result, Black American music is a little bit more codified than others. The blues basically came out of the voice emulating the drum, making the rhythm of it, the slickness of it, bending notes, doing with the voice what we used to do with the drums. So I think that's what makes the Black American experience quite unique and worthy of its own name, rather than just saying all the diaspora. But everybody has their opinion. You know, I'm sure there's many people who's going to debate me on that. I'm not interested in debating.
No.
I just want to do what I want to do.
Exactly.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And what you're listening to in the background is filled from Marcus Strickland's Twilight release, People of the Sun, released last November on Blue Note Records. Marcus Strickland on alto saxophone. He's also the composer. Mitch Henry on organ and keyboards. Kyle Miles on bass. Charles Haynes on drums and percussion. Before Build, we heard Seek the Source from Christian McBride's New John, 2018 Mack Avenue Records. Christian McBride on bass, Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone, Josh Evans on trumpet, Nasheet Waits on drums. Before that, we heard Rotation from Tane and the Ebonics, 2007, Dark Key Music. Folks Songs, Jeff Tane Watts on drums, Christian McBride on bass, David Gilmore on guitar, Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone and soprano saxophone, Dave Kukoski on piano. Before that, Butch and Butch from Roy Haynes, 2004 Dreyfus Jazz release. Fountain of Youth, Roy Haynes on drums, Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone, alto saxophone, and bass clarinet, Martin Bergerano on piano, John Sullivan on bass. Before that, At Last, from the Marcus Strickland Quartet. This is Marcus Strickland's debut release as a leader, 2009 Fresh Sound New Talent label. Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone, alto saxophone. He's also the composer. Robert Glasper on piano, Brandon Owens on bass, and Marcus's twin brother EJ on drums. Before that, we heard Timing from People of the Sun. Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone, bass clarinet, and composer on this selection. Mitch Henry on organ and keyboards. Kyle Miles on bass. Charles Haynes on drums. Weedy Brahma on congas. And of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from a compilation, The Very Best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. Originally recorded in 1967, and this RCA BMG compilation was released in 1998. We're going to hear a quick selection after Build, titled Cloaked in Controversy, also from the People of the Sun release. And Marcus Strickland will be playing alto saxophone, sopranino saxophone, synth, drum programming, and he is also the composer. Melanie Charles is one of the vocals in dialogue. Casey Hearns is the other person in dialogue. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams and more from Marcus Strickland on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Sirens making nervous.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for January 6th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar My Bowl guests. You can see them live. And this week's guest is Marcus Strickland. You can see him and the Twilife Ensemble at the Mercury Lounge on January 11th. That event's part of the New York City Winter Jazz Fest, which runs through the 12th at various venues in and near Greenwich Village, with marathon nights of music with several acts in different locations on the nights of the 11th and 12th, and separate standalone events in the days before. We have more festival details coming at the bottom of the segment, and you can see a preview of the standalone events this week right now on our blog. We also have our annual in-depth cheat sheet to help you plan for next week's marathon days coming soon, but before that, we have more listings for you this week. We start with vocalist Catherine Russell, who's at City Winery on January 7th. Drummer Andrew Surreal is at the Zurcher Gallery for a solo performance on January 9th, and that's actually a preview of this spring's Vision Festival, put on annually by Arts for Art. Drummer Francisco Mora Catlett leads Afrohorn at Brooklyn Sister's Place on the 12th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions series continues with late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 12th and 26th. Drummer William Hooker is at the Bowery Poetry Club on the 13th with bassist William Parker. He'll also be at Shapeshifter Lab in Brooklyn on the 23rd. Saxophonist James Brandon Lewis is at the Bowery Poetry Club on the 14th with Heroes Are Gang Leaders in an Amiri Baraka tribute. Bassist Ron Carter is at the Village Vanguard with Emmett Cohen's trio from the 15th through the 20th. Trumpeter Freddie Hendricks is at Zinc Bar on the 16th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 16th. Looking further ahead, tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 19th. Finally, we wrap up with more details on the 2019 Winter Jazz Fest, and it's underway right now and running through the 12th at various venues around Greenwich Village. And again, marathon nights are on the nights of the 11th and 12th, and there are individual events and also talks on other nights. To highlight a few specific events, Terrence Blanchard and the E-Collective and Terry Lynn Carrington's Social Science are at Les Poissons Rouges on the 7th. Medeski, Martin, and Wood are at Brooklyn Steel on the 9th. On the 10th, you can choose between Michelle and Diego Ocello, who is this year's artist in residence, and she's going to be at New Blue, and Gary Bartz and Farrah Sanders team up to recreate their Another Earth release for its 50th anniversary, and that's at Les Poissons Rouges. We have the full schedule linked in our blog at blog@sugarinmybowl.org. That's blog.sugarinmybowl.org. And our cheat sheet will give you a guide to the marathon nights and stop by for coverage after it's over. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. And if you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The Support WBAI link on our website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off, and this is our last Sunday show as we move to a weekly Tuesday night schedule at 10 p.m., and that's actually starting this Tuesday, January 8th. We hope you'll stay with us at the new time, and we'll still be updating listings online. Either way you connect, we'll see you Tuesday on the Bandstand.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
So speaking of what you do, if I have it correctly, you play tenor, alto, soprano, saxophone, and now, not now, more recently, you have incorporated bass clarinet, which I really enjoy.
Yes.
Every time I hear the bass clarinet, I think of Benny Maupin.
Oh, yeah. Love him. Yeah. I thought you were going to say Eric Dolphy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Indeed. How yes. could I?
Well,
yes.
Both
definitely both of them. I think I say Benny Maupin, particularly when I'm hearing your music, is because I think of M1Dishi. And type of exploration that they had taken in that music. So what attracted you to bass clarinet?
It was actually a Mad Villainy record. Mad Villainy 2, the something remix tape. I can't remember exactly the name of this record, but there is a song on there. I think it's called Boulder Holder. I need to look all this stuff up. It had this very low sounding woodwind. I think it had been slowed down from the original tempo. And to hear that sound mixed in with the drum program and everything like that, it was very inspirational. Also, there's a song called Accordion. It's a significantly slowed down recording of an accordion. And it sounds like a reed because the accordion has a reed in it. Actually. And I like the sound of that, how that sound was kind of like in the cello tenor range, and meanwhile you would have like a very low bass line underneath that, and you would have the drums there. So it creates this very thick sound underneath the melody or underneath the vocals. And I got a clarinet. It was around the same time that I got the stuff to make beats.
Oh.
It was 2002. I won the saxophone competition, third place with the prize money. I was like, what am I going to do? I got a G5. That's what was out at that time. And I got Reason, and I got Pro Tools. And I also bought a very, very cheap bass clarinet on eBay. That was my very first bass clarinet. One of three bass clarinets I've owned. I started trying to record the bass clarinet and put it over the beats. And it was quite sad when I first started. I ain't gonna lie. But it developed into what I'm doing now. I'm trying to get more serious about it. And it's kind of my way of torturing myself not listening to my band teacher when he said to play the clarinet. What I appreciate about my career is that I'm going with my gut. I'm not overthinking it. I'm not being like, but what about what people are going to think if I do? I'm not doing any of that stuff. I'm not thinking, what about our, you know, would it betray our ancestors? I'm not thinking of any of that stuff. I'm doing what I want to do. And it's led me down some very, very liberating paths. I really enjoy it, although I respect the culture and really have a high regard for all the guys that I listen to. I think it pays even more homage to do what they did, which is brave those waters that are not discovered. You know, take a chance and do some stuff that you want to do that is not necessarily the status quo. I really respect them for that more than anything. All these guys were rebels.
Is there anyone, speaking of those guys or some ladies, I guess,
Definitely.
There any mentors, previous performers that you like to look at as a mentor of sorts?
Oh, many. Of course, Roy Haynes. Of course, Jeff Jane Watt, because I played with them. And also, I listened to their recordings growing up. Also, Branch Marsalis. A lot of my style and stuff comes out of his playing, very rhythmic. Listening to Branch Marsalis led me to Coltrane and to Sonny Rollins and Wayne Shorter and Joe Henderson, because that's all inside of his sound. But I really admire him as a person and as a musician. And there's a couple of teachers that I had at New School that really took me under their wing. I really enjoyed studying with Patience Higgins. He really opened me to trying to learn other woodwinds. He plays just about anything, including oboe. He's one of those dudes. I had a lot of incredible support at the New School from Ellie Howell. She's the one who was recruiting a lot of musicians when I went to New School.
Recruiting them into the New School?
Yeah. I'm not sure how they go about recruiting people now, but a lot of things changed once she left. The demographic changed drastically. But because of her, there were incredible musicians that I went to school with, like Robert Glasper, Mike Marino, Deion Tucker, who I grew up with in Miami. Also the Rodriguez brothers, who I grew up with in Miami. So many incredible musicians, Kenyatta Beasley, Casey Benjamin. I'm not sure who was exactly recruited by L.E. Howell at this point, but I also went to school with the likes of Georgia Ann Muldrow and Jemiah Williams, who has a group called Aramage.
Yes.
Corey King, trombonist, who's in that group, and John Ellis, saxophonist and bass clarinetist. The list goes on. Just a very incredible amount of talent that I went to the school with. A lot of people favor the time that they went to school, but I think I have a lot of solid reasons why. So
you actually also wound up working with a lot of the people that you went to school with, which is what students tend to do these days.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, definitely. That's very, very true. So I consider all those people mentors. Yeah, I think one of the main things that students or mentees to keep in mind is that at some point they got to start thinking for themselves.
Right, exactly.
That's the next level. You know, once that started, I was like, oh, okay, this is where I started realizing what made Wayne Shorter Wayne Shorter. He started thinking for himself and he started accumulating his own compass, even in life, his religious choices. I mean, it's not even religion, it's like a way of living.
Choice.
Yeah, it's very cool. I really dig all the things I'm starting to learn later in life, both as a musician and as a person through gaining that compass. And I know some other people who probably just stayed exactly where they were, which is totally fine. I just know that I'm very appreciative that I can get on the bandstand with something that's more traditional and be just as home as playing on the bandstand with something that's a little bit more experimental or something that's not really the status quo. I'm really thankful for that kind of career.
your recording career. If I'm looking at it correctly, I think it started in 2001. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Was the first release, the On the Loose release, Sharp 9, Class of 2001?
I'm not sure if that came out first. My first release as a leader was At Last.
Yes, At Last. I was essentially talking about your recording as a human
first
being.
First recording period.
Yes.
My God. Sharp 9? That might be true. You know what? I think chronologically, I recorded At Last before we did Sharp 9.
Okay.
But I'm not sure about the release date.
Yeah, it's all in the same year, though. That's what I see. What was the difference in your experience playing around town in your groups live and then going into the recording studio?
Oh, I noticed that I had a deeper respect for the musicians that I've been listening to all this time, because being in the studio is a totally different environment than being live. Live, you have so many things to feed off of. The people, actually the nervous energy that you get when you get on stage sometimes, like that kind of feeds me too. But when you're in the studio, it's so clinical sometimes. Like, okay, take one. It's not really the same energy. So you have to kind of create it yourself. That's if you want it in there. That's something that I had to learn to get even when I'm behind a microphone and just like some plexiglass or whatever they're using to divide me from the rest of the band.
Right.
That it was definitely a totally different environment than playing in a band room or for rehearsal or playing on stage. And also it's kind of like a magnifying glass of your shortcomings. Everything that you're failing at right in front of you, and it becomes magnified. So it was a very deep experience. I really enjoyed that I got to do it at such a young age.
With regard to recordings, my introduction to you as an artist was actually by way of Brandy Younger, the harpist.
Oh, great, yeah, love it.
And she had played on one of your releases, I think, Of Song, I think it is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How'd you wind up working with Brandy? Where did you meet?
I think I met through EJ, because EJ was playing with Robbie Coltrane, and I think Robbie started using Brandy, and that was the first time that I heard her play.
Got it.
Also, I'd heard her play Desron. Yeah, I really love the sound of that instrument. It's just a majestical instrument.
Brandy Younger plays harp.
And that sound is definitely something that I was looking for on that particular recording. I couldn't think of anybody else, because she is definitely, I think, a trailblazer for her generation in terms of how versatile she is on the harp. She can fit into any situation, and there's not many people who can do that on that instrument.
Right.
You know, there's one other harp player I could think of, was Elio something.
Oh, Villafranca.
Yeah.
Elio Villafranca.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not the easiest instrument to write for. It's not the easiest instrument to fit in certain situations, but she was definitely my best choice for that, because she's just an incredible force. I'm glad she's here. I'm glad she's kind of like taking on the torch that Alice and Dorothy set.
Alice Coltrane and Dorothy Ashby.
Exactly. It was definitely a pleasure to have her on that recording, and I'm glad I did it.
Thank you.
which you're listening to right now is Jorolen, Jorolen, from Marcus Strickland's 2009 Crisscross Jazz release of Song. Marcus Strickland on tenor and soprano saxophone. Umar Sangare is the composer. Brandy Younger is on harp. David Bryant on piano. Ben Williams on bass. And E.J. Strickland on drums. Before that, we heard For Fewer Words from the 2001 Sharp Nine Records Last of 2001 release, On the Loose. Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone and soprano saxophone, Julius Tolentino on alto saxophone, Jeremy Pelt on trumpet, Jeb Patton on piano, Brandon Owens on bass, and E.J. Strickland on drums. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
You were talking about how it was kind of difficult to write for the harp. And I guess I want to find out, in general, you probably composed before you got there, but was it the new school that helped you compose better or differently or expand the knowledge?
Oh, definitely not. I wish it was something that I could learn in school.
Okay.
But, I think my compositional skills probably expanded the most while I was in high school because I had an incredible private lesson teacher by the name of Whit Seidner. He showed me what those chord symbols mean. Say, put down your saxophone, let's get on the piano. When you see this chord symbol, that means this. Having me have this personal relationship with chords, finally, that was in high school. From that, I got a very good harmonic foundation for composing music. The rhythm, the melodies, that stuff was already there. But, like, really understanding harmony the way that Whit Seidner taught me, I think that's one of the most valuable things towards writing music that I've accumulated over the years.
And I think I read somewhere that presently you have in your process of composition, you start with a beat, or you start with a beat as in creating beats. You create a beat.
Definitely.
And then you build on that.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? The beat just comes to you while you're sipping tea or something, and then you write it down, or walking down the street, or how?
It's definitely a large variety of places that I get inspired. I could be on the toilet. And the great thing about it is that I can scat the beat, try to maybe voice memo it, because now we have recorders everywhere we go.
Right.
And get back home and try to emulate that on the drum machine. But the greatest thing about composing from beats is that you start with more than a song. Actually, less than a song, but more of a texture. Because there's like certain things you have to do. There's certain sounds you have to pick in order to convey what's in your mind. Like if I'm thinking a certain rhythm, it's not going to sound the same with a long bass drum sound or a boomy bass drum sound as opposed to a very muffled and short one. Or the hi-hat is what I've learned is a very, very, very important part of making a beat sound good is the timbre of the hi-hat and also the timbre of the snare. It just changes everything about how the beat lays and goes through your body when it gets to the speakers. So it's like it started expanding me from a composer to a producer.
Okay.
And it kind of forced me to come up with ideas rather than try to come up with the whole song then and there. I think that's a very good thing because forcing it out and trying to complete it right then and there, I think it's not as heartfelt as having an idea, sitting with it. It might be on your disc for like maybe years. And then somehow, some way, that idea expands into a song. You go through your library and you hear this idea that you recorded, like, you know what? I think I'm ready to make that into a song. It's definitely made me into a better composer to do it that way. And it's also definitely expanded from composer to producer.
I actually noticed that on your previous release, prior to People of the Sun, was it Nihil Novi?
Oh, Nihil Novi.
Your producer on that was Michelle Ndegiocello.
Mm-hmm.
How did she wind up being part of the project? And I understood that you learned a lot from her having been on the project.
Oh, definitely. Well, she's definitely one of the heroes that I listened to growing up. All of her records are just amazing. When she first started out, it was a more pop-oriented environment for her. She has some hits, but like I feel like her music develops in a way that is much more organic and true than most people model their careers. A lot of people just follow the money. She doesn't. She follows her artistic whim. Another person who's like that, I feel, is Bjork. I really appreciate that artistic integrity that she has. She very much is a person that you cannot put into a box. So I was always listening to her stuff. I was listening to Cookie Anthology, The World Has Made Me, The Man of My Dreams. There's so many records of hers that are just gems to me. So I think in 2013, I played Winter Jazz Fest, and I wanted to premiere some new music for Twilight that I was thinking of. And that's when I changed up my band because I realized that I needed a different type of player on just about every instrument in order to pull it off right. So in 2013, I presented my new Twilight band, and the drummer was Charles Haynes. The bassist was Mark Kelly. Both
who are with you now.
Who, well, Mark Kelly, he's with the Roots now.
Excuse me. Charles Haynes is. I know. Sorry.
Snapped him up a little bit. More power to them.
Yeah.
Both of them have worked with Michelle extensively. I've seen them play in a quote-unquote jazz environment and a quote-unquote soul music environment.
Right.
All these different genres that we put up. They just played the music, and they were true to whatever they were on stage with, and it showed how versatile they are as musicians. Seeing Charles Haynes swing playing with Jeremy Pelt, then a couple of years down the road, seeing him play with Michelle and Soho, I was just like, oh my God, man. Okay, that's the thing I need for this next record that I'm about to put out. So we played at Winter Jazz Fest in 2013, and because of their relationship with Michelle, Michelle came down to check it out. She's very much into music, but to see this maestro, this hero of mine, like digging the music and loving it, I was in awe. I got very excited, and that gave me the audacity to ask her to produce my record. And I asked through Charles Haynes, and she was very kind. She said yes. It was definitely a surprise, but so glad I did it. It taught me so much.
What did you learn?
I think I learned that the studio is yet another instrument. And she very well knew this instrument. She knew her way around the studio, knew all kinds of technical aspects of engineering. She was familiar with it. She could use the same jargon as the recording engineer. All that knowledge had been gained from years of doing this. You know, yeah. She's been out here. So having all that and putting it all together like a fine-tuned orchestra right in front of me was all the tools I needed. It basically taught me that I need to learn about as many aspects of this process as possible in order to become the producer I want to become. That's the difference between saying, that sounds horrible, compared to saying, hey, I would like a little bit more warmth on this sound.
Oh, yeah. That's more helpful. More constructive.
Yeah,
and you get what you want.
Yeah. But I learned countless things. Just as being a human being, she's not your typical type of person. So I learned about managing personalities through her. I learned about accepting people for who they are and learning the human side of making a record as well. She's an incredible person. I really thank her for doing that. She definitely didn't have to help little old me. That's very generous of her.
I want to take this time to acknowledge that Michelle Indigo-Cello is the artist in residence of this year's New York Winter Jazz Festival. Now, we're going to talk about People of the Sun. It was released in November, was it not?
Yes, November 9th.
There's one thing that I noticed that sort of is throughout. You can really hear the drums, and you have plenty of voices speaking.
Oh, yeah.
Are those your words? As a matter of fact, I think the Greg Tate one he wrote.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's definitely great. He's a wordsmith. He is wordsmith number one.
And this is on My Mind.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a conscious decision to have the drums as prominent?
Oh, yes. I'm not sure how current this phenomenon is, but I noticed around the time that I started recording that the drums tend to get mixed down pretty low in the mix. And I thought, okay, the mixing engineer knows best. So I didn't really say anything in those mixing sessions. But as the years went on, I started saying a little something more. I was like, you know what? I want to hear the floor tom when he hits it. I mean, it's there for a reason, right? Let's bring that up. Bring that bass drum up so that the bottom of the kit became more prominent the more hands-on I became in the music-making process. And then I think by the time I got to Nihil Novi, the original person I wanted to record and mix it was Ben Kane. And Michelle, she was like, well, we could have Bob Power do this one. And Bob Power is incredible. I mean, he's the guy. He's the guy that everybody goes to as a template for learning this trade. So having him mix Nihil Novi is an incredible experience. I learned through Ben Kane that there's a whole other world of engineering outside of the typical jazz mixing engineer world. And it's like when you turn the volume down on a track and you can't hear the drums anymore, no. It's just like it doesn't have the same power as being able to hear it at any volume. I like to hear the bass like over anything. You know, if I have it low, I still want to hear that bass line. And also technology has changed a lot. A lot of people listen to music on their little tiny phone with little microscopic speakers. So it's like if you turn the drums down in the mix, things need to be compressed in order to work over the expansive amount of devices that music is listened to. People used to have incredibly huge speakers in their house, right?
And on the street.
So it's like, yeah. And the music, like mastering is basically the standard of recording at the current time. So at that time, mastering was very dynamic. You could hear that the drums were far behind the saxophone in terms of the distance from you. You could hear the distance, but when you put that same recording on a small, tiny speaker on a phone, you just don't hear the drums at all. So that's why I'm so glad that I went down this route, because it goes along with the type of music that I'm recording these days. I like to hear that bass drum. I want to hear the bass loud. There's some tracks that I don't want the horns to be on top of. Like, for instance, Aim High.
Love Aim High. Aim High is the song that I used on the promo.
Oh, great. Yeah. Aim High, I use the horns as they're basically like spirits. behind Jermaine Holmes.
The vocalist.
Yeah, the rhythm section. I had them lay that down first, and it was maybe 2 years until I came up with what to put over it with horn-wise.
Okay.
First the vocals came, and then after the vocals came, I was like, okay, we're going to be the spirits around that.
And you play bass clarinet on that one, too, which is really cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. A lot of the thinking that goes into my records nowadays is less ego-based and much more based on what's needed for that particular track. So Marvelous, also, I used the horns. I wanted them to sound as if they were sampled. Mm-hmm. So me and Keon were laying down the horns, and I specifically told Ben Kane to bury them in the mix as if they're like a sample from a record.
Okay.
There's a lot of decisions like that that go into my records these days, rather than, turn off the saxophone. I want to hear nothing but me.
Well, that was probably never the case anyway, so. Because you seem rather generous with what you're doing in the studio. Everybody gets to be heard.
Definitely.
The vocals, we didn't talk about that. There are lots of sort of vocal vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like people are on the phone talking to you. Who are these people?
Yeah. Oh, these are very important people to me. I basically wanted to immortalize the people who are most important to me in my life on this recording. That's what I'm thinking of when I say people of the sun. I'm very thankful for these people for being in my life, namely my dad, my mom, also a very close friend of mine named Angelica Beener, and also my ex-wife, Dawn Strickland, friend of mine that I've known like basically half of my life, Petra Richterova.
Yes, she was the one that actually connected you with Greg Tate, I believe.
Exactly. Her whole story is quite amazing. She's from Prague, but you would never know it when talking to her. You would think she's definitely from maybe the South in America. And she has an affinity for the Black experience, the African experience, the diaspora. That is quite overwhelming. My relationship with her has shown me the possibilities of simply seeking the source. That's something that she does for a living. She's a professor. She has a PhD
in Africology. Right.
Yeah. She's just a very interesting person that I feel that the world needs to know more about. I would say the same thing for my ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the same thing for Angelica Beener, my parents, Vanessa and Mike Strickland. So I want the world to know about these people in the best way. I want the world to hear them the way that I hear them,
mm-hmm.
you know, like when I need a little bit more, when I need another boost of the energy that these people provide in my life, I speak to them on the phone and you hear it all distorted and you hear it all kind of, what did you say?
Yes.
You know, laughing and stuff. So that's basically how I wanted to record them. I didn't want to record them cleanly in the studio because it kind of takes away from the authenticity. It was cool. I really enjoyed those interviews about Black love, especially hearing my dad.
There's also another sound that you have across this release, and I guess it's part of the Twilight sound as well. The organist. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Mitch Henry?
Yes, it definitely became a staple of the sound when doing pre-production for Nihil Novi, which was led by Charles Haynes, who is also an incredible contribution to that sound, the development of the song on Nihil Novi. When we're doing pre-production, he was saying, yo, man, this song Truth, man, if you could change it to another key and add some organ on that, you know, I was like, really? And we did it, and it turned out incredible. So I'm very appreciative of him and his contribution as well.
Now, is that Big Yuki on Nihil Novi?
Yeah, he's playing on there too. It's Yuki and Mitch on the keys, synths, and all that stuff. And Mitch plays the organ. Whenever you hear organ, that's definitely Mitch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, slick guy. That's one of the things that's very eye-opening about starting to have well-developed visions of music. There's only a few people on this earth who can do it. And once you realize that, you got to put the investment into them. You have to invest and make sure that everybody gets their due shine and respect and credit and all that stuff. So all these things I learned through working on Nihil Novi. It was much more than the prior experiences of, okay, that was a good take. We'll keep that one. So yeah, it's definitely changed the way that I approach making a record. And I'm very thankful for all the people who helped me get there.
At the New York Winter Jazz Festival, one of the marathon nights, January 11th. Where are you going to be?
Oh, in Mercury Lounge.
I actually like that venue. It's a nice spot to be. And since they're not...
I actually haven't been there yet.
Really? Never? Oh, my gosh. And I suspect you will be presenting a lot of People of the Sun?
Oh, yes. We're going to have a whole lot of People of the Sun, a whole lot of Nihil Novi as well.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like after touring off of Nihil Novi for a little bit, the set has basically become a DJ set. We're about to play all the hits.
Okay.
All our personal hits. And it works quite seamlessly, and we prefer one long set instead of separate sets.
Oh.
But we can do both. We've done it all. The programming, it feels like when you go on your iPhone and go to a playlist, play all the stuff that you like. We want it to feel that way because that's how people listen to music now.
Right. Do you know who your personnel is going to be?
Yes, it's Mitch Henry on organ keys, Kyle Miles on bass, and Charles Haynes on drums.
Okay. And you will be playing how many horns this time?
I think it'll be three this time.
Okay.
Bass clarinet, the tenor saxophone, and the alto saxophone.
Okay. Of course,
I might throw some soprano in there. Who knows?
You know, I was thinking, if you manage to put it in whatever you're traveling in or carry it with you, then I guess it'll be there.
Oh, yeah.
I understand that you actually purchased something to help you with traveling with your horns.
Oh, yeah.
You want to tell us about that?
Oh, definitely. The whole travel situation, that's what we're going to pay for. Getting on stage and playing music, that's fun. But the travel, that's the work. And you have to be cunning because the airlines are coming up with different rules about carry-on. And every single person is different. You have to definitely become more of a people person to explain why they can't put this expensive instrument underneath so it can be tossed and turned and damaged.
Right.
I basically have two cases because the most carry-ons that you're allowed is two these days.
Right.
The thing is, they say one carry-on and one personal item. And my thing is, they're both.
Right.
There's personal item and it's a carry-on.
Right.
I have a case that goes on my back. It's a tube made by Wiseman. That's the company. It's just this tube. They figured out how to suspend in midair the bass clarinet and the soprano saxophone in that same case.
Okay.
That case fits in every single plane I have been on, whether it's like a little tiny jetliner joint or a big giant Boeing. I have that one, and I have my tenor case, which is made by Manning Custom Woodwinds. He makes everything that you can think of for the saxophone. He makes the saxophone, he makes the mouthpiece, he makes the neck strap, the reeds, he makes the case, anything that you can think of for a saxophone, he makes it.
All right.
Manning is an incredible guy, so I use his case for my tenor. He discovered this way of packing the instrument in the case so that it can't move at all. The last step is to take your particular instrument and custom fit the case so that it does not move.
Nice.
Because you can have the hardest case you want, but if it moves within the case, it's bad that it's a hard case.
Wow.
Yeah, so I have that, and sometimes I have to gate check it, and I always have a tear in my eye when I see it taken away from me.
But you know it will survive under the plane.
There's been like about three cases in which my instrument got damaged, even in that case. But that's the thing. It's never guaranteed.
Okay.
But it pretty much does the job. But it's cool.
See, now we're going to talk about just stuff you as a working human musician have to deal with. If you get to your destination and you open the case and you get past the tier of finding out that your instrument has been damaged, what do you do? What is the next thing?
Oh, well, the first thing I want to do is get on the phone and get the dopest local repairman I can find.
Okay.
If I can't do that, I try to get somebody else's instrument to play.
Oh, okay.
There's countless things that I've had to do in scary situations like that, but we always find a way to make work. Sometimes I gotta just not play the instrument. Hopefully I'm playing another saxophone that day. Recently I was on the road and I discovered my soprano was damaged, so I just couldn't play it on the gig.
Right.
That's probably the most stressful part of being a musician is traveling with your instrument, because there's no liability for the airlines, and only TSA has specific rules for musicians with carry-on.
Really?
Yeah.
The airline doesn't. It's actually TSA that puts out these rules?
Just for the American travel within America, we have these rules that kind of protect our right to have two carry-ons. But outside of that, which is most of the travel that I do,
yeah,
it's international travel, you have a whole different set of rules at almost every single airport and also with every single person that you encounter at the ticket counter.
Wow.
Quite a stressful thing.
Name a place and what happens there that's different from what happens here.
Oh, well, for instance, I think I was in Melbourne going to Sydney, and then I was going to go back to the United States. And they were looking at my instrument, and they're like, "That? Oh, no, that can't go on board." I'm like, "Why? What's the reason?" It's like, "It's an instrument." I was like, "That's exactly why it should go on board." It's a very expensive thing. It's much more fragile than underwear. You know, it's like, yeah, I should be able to put it on. And the thing that they least like to hear is that I do this all the time.
Oh.
Like, you show them your passport, you show them how much you travel, then that puts them in a defensive kind of mood. That's why I'm saying you have to kind of become a people person and speak in a way that is not going to hurt the ego of this person who's trying to enforce this rule on you.
Wow.
I think I talked my way out of that one. I said, one thing that I like to default to is say, well, could I at least try? And if it doesn't, I could easily gate check it. That's what I start with. Sometimes I have to go further. And from there, it's improvisation.
Yes.
Whatever kind of person I'm dealing with.
Wow. Well, it's a good thing you play this music then.
Yes, it is. Definitely is. I'll be on your toes.
Now, there's one last thing I want to ask you about. You had a record label at one point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still do.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it.
I learned a lot about the industry, and I have much more respect for the labels out here. I understand their side of the story much more clearer than before. As an artist, we have all these demands and everything, but we got to keep in mind that every single little tiny decision we make, it costs money.
Right.
I'm talking about package design, stuff like that. At the time that I was making my records on Strict Music, to have a digi pack costed more.
Wow. And to have a jewel case.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly the reason, but the reason that I wanted digi packs is because you can sign anywhere on the thing when you give the CD out to the person. You can make it a matte finish so that it's easy to sign with a pen or a felt tip pen. So I made that decision, but then I said, whoa, why not everybody has a digipack? Cool. All right. A lot of things like that would register to me, and I would be like, okay, this is why they do what they do. They're not just evil. I mean, some of them are, but like, they have their reason.
Right.
So I learned a whole lot about the record making process. I got more involved because I was running the actual cash flow of the session.
Right.
So I had to know much more than before. I had to know how many hours we were going to spend mixing, what could be done within that time, how long the mastering process should take, and how important it is to get somebody who absolutely knows what the hell they're doing in order to do so. And I learned a little bit about mixing by just watching the engineers do what they do too. So I'm glad that I went through that. It's part of why I'm the person I am today.
So you say that you still have the label. Do you plan to do things with it at some point?
Oh, definitely. I feel that nothing is forever. Mm-hmm. So it's like, if I'm not on the record label forever, I can always still release music on my own label. Yeah, I can do it at any time, actually.
Okay.
It's the knowledge that I can do it is forever here. It hasn't stopped. Right now, somebody else is taking the bill.
Okay. Cool. As a matter of fact, okay, one more one. You were included in the Blue Note film, Beyond the Notes, I think it's called. Sophie Huber. Did that pretty much document the Blue Note All-Stars release that you did? Was that essentially where that footage derived?
A big part of the footage of me, Ambrose, and Robert and
Lionel Lewicki
and Derek in the same room. Whenever you saw all of us in the same room, they was at that session. And Herbie and Wayne, too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that the first time you met them?
That was maybe the third time I met both of them. And every time, it feels like the first time. They're like gods to me. I really respect them, of course. And they're just so relaxed. There's something about that wisdom that is so so relaxed and comfortable, and I really appreciate it. They're not tripping about anything. Whenever I'm around them, I know everything's going to be all right.
Did you get to see the film, by the way?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
I saw it at the premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good one. Actually, Sophie said there's going to be a release of some sort. Don't know when, don't know where.
I really, really hope for that, because I want that film to reach as many eyes as possible. That has to be seen, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very good documentation of not only Blue Note, but the music as a whole, and also Black Americans' contribution to it. You know,
yes.
It was never really outwardly said, but it's there. Like, this is our stuff.
Okay.
Nobody else can share it. It did come from us.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Marcus Strickland. I really appreciate all the time that you spent with us. Ooh, boy, we've been chatting it up. I'm really grateful for you making this time. You getting ready to hit the road? You leaving town?
I'm actually going to be in town March. I'm going on the road for the first time with my Twilight fan in the United States.
Okay.
Prior to that, I've been touring a whole lot of Europe all the time, and every now and then I'll go to some kind of city in the United States. But yeah, hitting the United States, Midwest and the West, that's definitely a first for this band.
Excellent.
Cool.
All right, Marcus, thank you so much.
Cool, thanks. Take care.
Listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl and our closing program on Sunday evenings. We will be moving to Tuesday evenings from 10 to midnight. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening was Marcus Strickland. What you're listening to right now is Aim High from the People of the Sun release. Marcus Strickland on tenor saxophone, bass clarinet. He's also a co-composer. Mitch Henry on keyboards. Kyle Mays on bass. Charles Haynes on drums. Jeremy Holmes is the lead vocalist and co-composer. And Keon Harold on trumpet. And I'd like to take this moment to send my condolences to Keon Harold for the transition of his mother. Instead of me talking over this song, you can come to the Mercury Lounge and catch Marcus Strickland. Marcus Strickland's Twilight group will be at the Mercury Lounge as part of the Winter Jazz Fest Marathon Night on Friday, January 11th. His set is scheduled to start at 10:40. The Mercury Lounge is at 217 East Houston Street, and you can find out more on our Sugar in My Bowl site, and you can hear the selections from People of the Sun uninterrupted. La Nueva Alternativa is scheduled next. Sugar in My Bowl will be back this Tuesday, January 8th. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.